Our guest on The Year That Made Me today is the Melbourne-born and bred writer and lawyer, Alice Pung. Alice is the daughter of ethnic Chinese Cambodian migrants who fled the killing fields of the Khmer Rouge for Melbourne in the 1980s. She's written the best-selling memoirs Unpolished Gem and Her Father's Daughter, the novels Lorinda and 100 Days. She's also an accomplished essayist and has edited anthologies including Growing Up Asian in Australia. These days, Alice is the writer-in-residence at Janet Clark Hall at the University of Melbourne. She's an adjunct professor in the School of Media and Communication at RMIT. And as well as that, she also works as a lawyer at the Fair Work Commission. Alice Pung, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Thanks so much for having me on your show, Julian.
It's great speaking with you. Now, Alice, you were born in Melbourne, but I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your parents' story and their lives before coming to Australia.
Yeah, sure. So my parents are both Chinese. They're Diaodil background and they were born in Cambodia. So a lot of the Diaodil people come from the south of China, from a place called Guangdong, and they migrated to Cambodia in years where there was famine or where there was scarcity of food. So my parents were both born in Cambodia to Chinese parents. And as you know, Cambodian history was fraught with the era of the killing fields. So 1975 to 1979, there was a mass genocide in Cambodia. So my parents migrated to Australia as refugees in 1980. And my mum was 8 months pregnant with me, but at the refugee camp. I think she told me that she held up one hand to say she was only 5 months along because she really wanted to get on that plane and make it out of there.
What sort of reception did your parents get when they arrived in Australia?
Oh, they thought Australia was this incredible paradise. So my father remembered a book he read when he was younger. It was translated from English into Chinese, and it was about a girl who finds herself in this magnificent wonderland. So he named me Alice because he really thought Australia was a wonderland.
It's a pretty tough thing, though, to set up a whole new life in a new country. Could you speak a little bit about the struggle and hardships that your parents faced and also what it was like for you growing up in that family and environment?
I grew up in the western suburbs, Julian, and you probably have similar suburbs in Sydney. It was tough, and it was tough depending on the political climate. So I'm a child of the 1980s and 1990s, and I saw things shift and I saw cycles happen. So in the 1980s, as you're aware, it was a period of multiculturalism. So in the streets of Braybrook, where I grew up, we were distinctly unsafe. You know, cars would sometimes follow us and holler obscenities at us, especially when I was a teenage girl going to and from my Catholic school, because the carload of, people had watched Full Metal Jacket and had seen terrible things, Vietnamese hookers and Apocalypse Now. And so that was happening in the streets of Braybrook, because Braybrook was quite economically depressed at that time. Globalization was happening and a lot of workers lost their jobs because the factories that they'd worked in for so long were being moved overseas and the work was being done by people who looked like me and my family, but overseas. And so that was happening. But at school, something different was happening. Our teachers were teaching us that we all had a right to exist and flourish because of multiculturalism. So, you know, you bring your national food in, we'd wear costumes. It seemed a little bit gimmicky when you look back in retrospect, but it was a wonderful thing because you were teaching other children that you existed in a certain way. And when you went home from school, your life was different. And then the 1990s rolled by and I was a teenager then. And the policy changed again to one of assimilation. And many of my friends got blue eye contacts or green eye contacts and dyed their hair blonde because they felt it was more favorable to be a mixed race Australian than ethnically Chinese or Vietnamese or whatever they were. And the second thing that happened was my dad, who'd always been quite entrepreneurial, his business started thriving. So when Pauline Hanson was saying, "Oh, these Asians, they come here and take our jobs," my father was actually at the heyday creating employment for 40 Australians. So that was a bit of a disjuncture that I, you know, couldn't quite reconcile as a 15, 16-year-old studying politics at school. It made no sense.
Yes, indeed. And your father was employing people at the Better Electrical store, which you've written about very lovingly as a place not only where your father was able to find economic success, but really a centre, a part of your world. What was it like hanging out in Better Electrical back in the day?
Oh, back in the day, Julian, it was called Retrovision. I'm sure you've had many Retrovision stores, but they're mainly mum and dad businesses. They're not big like Harvey Norman's. They were a bit smaller, and his was down a shopping strip in Footscray. So I'd been working there since I was quite young. When I was 12 or 13, obviously I wasn't a shop assistant, but I was writing the price tags for the kettles and the toasters because I was a good cartoonist, so I drew cartoons on the price tags. But as I got older, I did work at the Retrovision store. And again, it was interesting because it was in the suburb of Footscray and you got real characters in Footscray. And most of the real characters came because of another government decision. A premier of the time in the 1990s decided to close down a lot of the residential facilities where people with mental illness lived. And so they would end up wandering the streets of Footscray, and we got some real characters in the Retrovision store. There was a man who always came dressed like Tarzan. He had, you know, a cougar skin cloak on him, and he was in a wheelchair, and he brought meters and meters of speaker wire for some obscure reason, and a wonderful woman who always came with very dirty gardening gloves, Miss Beauty Queen Amelia, and she got me to type her receipts with that exact title there. So you get used to living alongside a community that's eccentric. That was a really good thing to break your teeth on as a writer.
And did you imagine being a writer at that age, Alice?
No, not really, because I didn't read any. Now we have the internet, and, you know, decade or so ago, you had that television series Fresh Off the Boat and The Family Law. And so back then we didn't have very much. Ando was just starting out as a comedian. This was the first time I realized Asians could be legitimately funny and recognized as such. So he was a big inspiration for my writing. And no, I just kept a notebook at work because I found these people interesting, and not interesting in a way that felt, judging of them, but interesting in a way that a young person at the age of 17 would find the first mass adult she'd encountered beyond her teachers and family doctor interesting.
On The Year That Made Me, we're speaking with author and lawyer Alice Pung. And Alice, you've talked a little bit about the emphasis on multiculturalism that you got within schools. You did go to a range of schools, some of which worked better than others, it seems. You experienced some pretty fierce competition in a selective school, and that experience inspired your 2014 book, Lorinda. I wonder if you could tell us about that, and also if it's had an enduring impact for you personally.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, I went to 5 different schools just out of circumstance. And, you know, the more my father's business thrived, the more he wanted us to really thrive educationally as well. So I started off in this great school. Every school has its advantages and disadvantages, by the way. And I'd know this very well as a visiting author of over 600 schools during my career. But my very first school was a school called Footscray Girls Secondary College. And I just remember, it's funny in retrospect, it wasn't back then. One of my friends, a girl went up to her and called her Refa, which means refugee. And she got really angry. My friend, who was about 4'9", really short, went up to the girl and grabbed her by her shirt collar and said, "What are you talking about? You know, I came here in 1979, you came here from the Bosnia conflict. You're the Refo." So we were really trying to outdo each other in how long we had been here, only because there's a stigma attached to being a boat person. And then I went to a few other schools. But the selective state school that you speak of, there's a few of them around Sydney and Melbourne as well. I just had a really hard time, Julian, because at that time there were many students like myself, Asian students from different backgrounds, and many of them are really, really good at maths and science, and I was the exception, and I really felt myself floundering at that school. And as a young person, your first experience of mental illness generally happens between the ages of, around 16 to 20, 23. I know that because I'm trained as a counsellor as well. And that was when I couldn't go to school anymore. I had a nervous breakdown, basically. But the positive side of this is that I go to that school. I return there quite often. Teachers invite me back and the principal as well to talk about mental health, not just to the students, because it's a really intense school, but to the parents and carers as well. So when the child first goes to the school, I've often talked to the parents and carers saying you can't put that much pressure on these girls. It's not fair.
When you look back at that time, what were the things that got you through and helped you to bounce back so effectively as you clearly did?
I like this question because it's one about resilience. And to be honest, it's just luck. I had a very loving family. It's hard to be resilient when you don't have a loving family. It's hard to be resilient when you become drug dependent, as some of my classmates did. And it's hard to be resilient when you don't get chances at life. So I've had all three things work in my favor as well. And growing up in the 90s, you know, this is back in vogue now, but back then it wasn't cool to be a Michael Jackson fan, but I was. And I mention this only because it's so interesting. Popular culture never reflected back anyone who was like me. And this young man from this working class suburb in Gary, Indiana, who was responsible for, you know, all his younger siblings and his older siblings as well, I really felt a connection there. And so, you know, it was really hard growing up at that time in working class Braybrook and Footscray to see some semblance of a future. The only professionals I encountered on a day-to-day basis were my teachers and the family doctor. No idea what lawyers look like or accountants or engineers because I'd never encountered those people.
Alice, you were also the eldest child in quite a large family. What were the pros and cons of that particular place in the pecking order?
Oh, well, as the eldest, you know, my parents always had these sayings. One of them was, oh, family's like a snake, and if the head is straight, the rest of the body follows accordingly. And I found out some of my other friends' parents said the same thing to them. And I'm the eldest daughter, so I was responsible for my younger siblings. Particularly, my dad was running his store, but my mother did something that she frightened us about. So she was an outworker. She worked in the garage. Some of the outworkers I knew made clothes for fashion brands. My mother made jewelry, and it was pretty horrible work. You know, she was in this unventilated shed dealing with potassium cyanide and really dangerous chemicals. So I was responsible for the younger siblings for a large part of the after-school hours and school holidays. And I'd go to High Point Shopping Center pushing a pram with a toddler in tow and a baby in the pram. And the cashiers at Target or at Safeway would look at me and give me really dirty looks as if I was a 14-year-old teen pregnancy. And I think, you're 16 years old, you're working at Safeway. How dare you judge me? Because it was that kind of a neighborhood. So, yeah, it's been really interesting because I have three children of my own, Julian. And when I had my son, I don't mean to brag, but it felt easier. It felt like a piece of cake being responsible for this baby and not being anxious about dropping them or anything like that. And then I realized, gosh, my parents trusted an 8-year-old with a newborn. That's just nuts.
Alice, I wonder if you could tell us about Uncle Martin and Auntie Stella and the role that they played in your life.
Oh, Julian, they're really special people in my life. They introduced me to books. So Uncle Martin and Auntie Stella were a beautiful Christian couple who visited the refugees who lived in the migrant hostel, the Midway Migrant Hostel in Maribyrnong. And at that time, they organised the delivery of furniture for these newly arrived refugees. They taught them how to do essential daily things, banking. And they kept in touch with my parents, even after my parents moved to their first rented house. And all through our childhoods and adolescence and well into adulthood, they would unfailingly visit us every year at Christmas, but on each of our birthdays. So each of us had our birthdays, and they would come, and they would come with books and gifts. And this was like having a fairy godmother and godfather. It was just unheard of, you know. And a lot of the books, that they were Christian books. And so my grandmother was Buddhist, but I got a very Christian upbringing from these books as well. And they gave me my first dictionary, and that's really significant. They gave me words.
What were the books that really resonated with you as a young reader?
Oh, well, the books they gave me, you know, were about hamsters having their first Easter, or Snoopy books, or, you know, The Greatest Man Alive, Jesus. The books that also resonated me that weren't gifted to me. We had a few books in our household. We had The Household Hint and Handy Tips, The Reader's Digest Guide, which my father bought for me when I was about 13 years old. And I didn't know, I hadn't studied feminist politics at that time. I thought it was a perfectly wonderful gift. So I knew all about dangerous plants and all about what a household should be like in Australia. Didn't quite resemble my household, but I could do amazing things with a watermelon for children's birthday parties. And we had another free book, Poisonous Snakes and Spiders. And when you go into migrant households, because there's wonderful free public libraries available, you'll find the books in the house are either gifts or these really practical books. But at the Footscray Library, which opened when I was about 13 or 14 years old, that's when I got my real education into literature, and no one had taught me. There were literary books, and there were books like Danielle Steele. So I read voraciously, and I read everything. And so when I write, I don't write in a way that, because my mother can't read or write in English. So, you know, and I grew up with these highly intelligent adults who didn't have much literacy. So I know literacy is very different from literature, and the ability to be literate and literary isn't confined to being able to read and write.
Are there particular authors who are like your inspiration for the style that you adopted in Unpolished Gem in particular?
Oh, I guess Unpolished Gem was inspired by an American Asian writer called Maxine Hong Kingston, who wrote in the 60s and 70s, a pivotal Asian Australian writer. And of course, the great Amy Tan, because at that time, there were also lots of books published from China and from Hong Kong by actually legit Chinese authors who'd grown up in China and Southeast Asia. But my experience is different. I'm an Australian. I was born in Australia, and I grew up here, and I had very similar childhood to my friends outside of our house, and inside of our house, I had a different upbringing. So the books from America that reflected that gave me a great source of what was possible.
Alice, why did you study law, and what was university like for you as an experience?
Oh, Julian, to be honest, I studied law because I got the marks, and my parents, look, you got these high marks, don't waste them. And I got a, you know, not a full scholarship, but I got some bursaries to help me through Melbourne Law School. And my parents had invested since I was a newborn in what they called milk money, which was this college fund that ended up to be, you know, $2,500 a year for 3 years when I got to university, which is not that much. But I was really touched that they'd done this, and the booklet was physical. I could see every week they'd put in a couple of dollars for this fund because they wanted me to go to university, the eldest born daughter. And I was really touched by that. Law school was an interesting experience, Julian, because that was when I realized that there were lots of students from private schools at Melbourne Law School, and it was a place of great learning, but also great inequities as well.
So, Alice Poong, what year have you chosen as the year that made you?
The year that made me, I've chosen as 2006.
And what happened in 2006, 20 years ago, Alice?
Oh, 20 years ago, my first book was published, a book called Unpolished Gem, that I had spent quite a while writing. I'd spent about 5 years writing and completing it while I was undertaking my law degree. Unpolished Gem wasn't meant to be a book. It was just a bunch of short stories that I had written. In particular, I just had this one short story, to be completely frank, and it got published in a magazine called Mianjin, which was run by Melbourne University. And an editor had read this short story I'd written and called me up out of the blue one day when I was 20 years old and said, I really like that short story you wrote and published in The Engine. Is it part of the book? And at the age of 20, I was probably really bad at writing short stories. So it probably didn't have the sense of completion a short story would. It probably sounded like a book chapter. You know, I probably didn't finish off satisfactorily, or it left you on a cliffhanger, which I hadn't meant to do. And instead of saying, no, I just have this one short story, I thought of Eminem, who was big at that time. You've just got this one chance. You have to take it. And so I said to this editor, I said, yes, Chris, it's actually part of a book I'm working on. And if you give me a few months, I can give you some chapters if you'd like. And he said, I'd love to see them. So during my university holidays, I furiously wrote the first 30,000 words of Unpolished Gem and delivered them to him in person.
And it came out in 2006, and the reception was really warm straight away. Did it have a transformative impact on your life in that year?
Oh, it really did, Julian, because, you know, I was quite fresh out of law school. I had done my article clerkship, worked a year at a lovely small firm in Port Melbourne, and then just started my career in the Australian Public Service, where I've been for the past 20 years of my life. And then this book came out, and it was unexpectedly, it sold out within a few weeks, its first print run. And so that was when we knew, when my publishers were telling me, you've got something really special on our hands, because I didn't know it was my first book.
You went on to write another memoir. How did writing those memoirs impact on your relationships with family, Alice?
Oh, you know, to be completely honest, because my mother can't read or write, you know, it hasn't impacted us that much. I have offered, I'd say, do you want me to tell you what's in this book? Do you want me to read it, translate it? And she goes, no, I'll just wait till the movie comes out. No, she's been waiting for 2 decades. But that's the difference between, you know, literacy and illiteracy. Your worlds are quite different. So my mum is really proud of me in the same way you'd be proud of a child who can do something that you can't fathom. In terms of my father, he's read all my books with his Chinese, French and English dictionary, because Cambodia was colonized by the French. So that's his first European language. And he's really proud of me. But the funny thing is, Julian, at my first book launch, he'd read the book the week before, because I didn't give him drafts or anything. I knew he'd censor me. And he got up at my book launch and said, I'm so proud of my daughter, Alice. But to be honest, if she'd shown me what was in this book, there's a lot I wouldn't have let her publish in there. And he said that jokingly. So the family are proud of me. Yeah.
And despite all the literary success that you've had, you've continued working as a lawyer, Alice. What sort of work do you do and why do you keep doing it?
Oh, I'll be completely honest. I had no idea that my writing career would last for 2 decades. I thought I was a flash in the pan. I thought, well, ethnic literature is hot for this year, maybe next year. And then, you know, this is it for me. And so I've always maintained my regular job at the commission. So I've been there for 2 decades and I've done a number of roles at the Fair Work Commission. And right now I'm the leader of the education team. So we make resources for Uber drivers, for people appearing before the commission for the first time. So that's my job. And I write and visit schools on the other day. So I work part-time and on the other days I do school visits, because a lot of my books are on curriculums or they're being studied by year 9 students or year 8, so that kind of thing.
Sounds very busy, not to mention with having 3 kids as well. You've obviously got a lot going on. Alice, you mentioned earlier the sort of economic downturn in the 1990s and how that seemed to have a sort of direct impact on the sort of racism that you and your family confronted. You've written about that also in the New York Times, describing that mood shift. At the same time, experiences of racism also seem to have been a bit of a regrettable constant throughout your life. How do you look at the drivers of racism in Australia over the years, and what's your perspective on where we're at with that in 2026?
Oh, Julian, racism has nothing to do with the colour of our skin or our background or our race, our ethnicity or religion. It's got everything to do with fear. And so I'm not so fearful and I'm quite optimistic, because I grew up, one of my best friends, her father was a One Nation supporter, but he loved us and he loved us in a genuine way in a way in which you could understand as a child. He would walk us home from birthday parties and he would save the sparklers for us. But when I'd go to his house, and I went to visit my friend as a teenager when I was 14, and I saw a massive poster of Pauline Hanson on his wall. She was draped in the Australian flag and looked very dashing. And I got really nervous and I said, what's that on the wall? And she said, I don't know, because she was 14 as well. She goes, my dad just likes his political party. And then he came out with two mugs of Milo for us and everything was okay, you know. And so he had very precarious jobs. He drove the lawnmower around the school. He delivered pamphlets around the neighborhood. And so when you switch on television and people were saying these Asians have come to take your jobs, or you read the paper and you feel like your jobs are being sent elsewhere, sent to people who don't look Australian, who aren't Australian, you get fearful. So racism is based on fear. And the trouble these days is we demonize these people, these working class people who are just scared because we weren't demonized in our neighborhood. Once people got to know us, they saw us as three-dimensional human beings that they loved and would support. And the father of my friend taped all my interviews and, you know, was so proud of me when my book came out. And so I guess I write as well to show people that we're not just refugees, we're not just immigrants, we're humans, just in the very same way everyone else is.
So in a time where the level of support for One Nation has dramatically increased, given those experiences, what's your perspective on how to react to that rise? What do you think works in terms of counteracting those fears, not only on a personal level, but in terms of the broader national debate?
Oh, that's a great question. Of course, your first reaction, and a very legitimate one, is you get angry. You think, why are people so racist against us after decades? But then if you take a long-term look at history, people have always been racist against Chinese Australians since the Gold Rush days. So it's nothing new. People who are shocked by racism probably are living under a false innocence, you know. So I'm not too shocked by racism. But it takes time and it takes patience and it takes overcoming your first knee-jerk, trigger-happy reaction to demonize the racist people because, you know, deep down, I reckon a lot of racists people don't perceive themselves as racist. They perceive themselves as looking out for the best interests of their loved ones, their nation, their community, whatever they're looking out for. And they're trying to keep these things they value and these people they value safe. And so you diffuse racism through a lot of patience and just talking to racist people, basically. My father-in-law said to me after he read my book, he had a window into a different world that he'd never thought much about before, because they're from a farming regional community where people like Pauline do have a huge influence.
And Alice, what are you working on now?
Oh, yeah, Julian, you know, it takes me a long time to write a book. So an adult book will take 4 years on average. So I've been working for a number of years on a book set in a childcare centre where an accident happens. Only because this is a world I know very well. I've got family who work in childcare and in aged care and in industries like that that are heavily feminised and probably paid, you know, significantly less. So it's not a political book or anything like that. It's just about a childcare centre and all the people who populate it and the things that happen in it.
It's been great speaking with you about your life, and thank you so much for joining us today on The Year That Made Me.
Thanks so much, Julian.
And we always finish with a piece of music. Alice Poong, what have you chosen for us and why?
Oh, I've chosen a song that was huge. It's not my year 2006, but it was the year 1999 because it's a year I came of age and people were saying how terrible it was and the future was looking so bleak because of technology, and I don't feel that way about the future. So it's Prince's 1999, which I think is a very optimistic and upbeat song.
And here it is. Alice, thanks again.
Thanks, Julian.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.